Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dory Smith. We're joined by investigative journalist and author David Lindorf.
The neocon group that has been like a cabal running the Bush administration has been actively promoting as much violent chaos as they could in the Middle East.
David Lindorf is a columnist for Counterpunch. He has written about the grave implications of Bush's executive orders. He's author of several recent books, including This Can't Be Happening, Resisting the Disintegration of American Democracy, and Killing Time, an investigation into the death penalty case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. David Lindorf's most recent book with Barbara Olshansky is The Case for Impeachment, the legal argument for removing President George W. Bush from office, that, of course, the American people have just done with a resounding vote for Barack Obama and his running mate, Joe Biden.
We know the challenges that tomorrow will bring are the greatest of our lifetime. Two wars, a planet in peril, the worst financial crisis in a century.
President-elect Barack Obama inspired a cheering crowd at Grant Park in Chicago, celebrating his victory and making some references to foreign and domestic policy themes that helped him achieve a resounding victory over Republican John McCain.
Even as we stand here tonight, we know there are brave Americans waking up in the deserts of Iraq and the mountains of Afghanistan to risk their lives for us. There are mothers and fathers who will lie awake after their children fall asleep and wonder how they'll make the mortgage, or pay their doctor's bills, or save enough for their child's college education.
David Lindorf, welcome.
Thank you for having me on, Dory.
Barack Obama and Joe Biden have promised to step up the war in Afghanistan, add 92,000 more troops to the U.S. military. If they're going to do that, where do they find the resources to deliver on other promises? What about these questions about foreign policy?
That's one of the most disturbing things about his campaign, was that he appears to have bought into this notion that we are fighting a war on terror, when in fact it isn't a war. And it's really a battle against a small group of terrorist criminals. And you don't fight that in and destroying a country and just creating more and more enemies. That should be clear by now. So it's disturbing. I'm hoping wiser heads will prevail at this point, because we're doing enormous damage to Afghanistan. And if we continue the latest thing that Obama seems to support of going across border into Pakistan and Syria and so on and attacking terrorist targets, we're going to just expand this thing, and it'll be a never-ending quagmire that'll destroy his administration.
Now, corporations that have done well under Bush-Cheney are in what we might call damage control anyway, but an executive at Carlyle appeared on Bloomberg TV, the financial network, November 5th, calling on Barack Obama to maintain continuity. What do you make of that request?
Well, the Carlyle Group is kind of the Bush family enterprise. Bush Sr. was on the board for years, and it's a private equity group that buys all kinds of oil operations around the world. And so for them to say that is totally understandable. They want the Bush operation to continue. But, I mean, if it were Halliburton saying the same thing, you'd sort of say, yeah, right, okay, I understand. But it's really bad advice, because I don't see how Obama can do any of the major initiatives that he's talking about unless he addresses what Barney Frank, the congressman from Massachusetts, had the courage to say recently, which is that we are going to have to reduce our outrageously huge military budget. We have anywhere between 800 and 1,000 overseas military bases, aside from two wars that are being run. The wars have to stop. That's $10, $12, $15 billion a month that we can't afford to spend, aside from the horrors of those wars and the unnecessariness of them. But then you also have the fact that we're spending, when you factor in all the things like interest and veterans benefits and everything, $1 trillion a year on the military. And that is the equivalent of what the rest of the entire world is spending on the military. This is ludicrous. You know, he's going to have to cut that if he is going to do these things like health care for basically everyone, or restoring Social Security to a core place as the basis for Americans' retirement and so on. You know, forget about fixing the infrastructure and all of the other stuff. That's a lot of money. I think he's going to have to address that issue. And what I'm hoping is that his talk about, you know, aggressively sending more troops into Afghanistan and of adding 92,000 men and women to the military force was just talk to get past McCain, and that saner heads will prevail.
Let's turn to Barack Obama's victory speech in Chicago. Did you see that Grant Park speech?
I was at the home of my son's best friend. It's an African-American family, and there were several other African-American families there. And it was just, for me, to watch them watching this rally was just such a mind-blowing event, you know, as a white person seeing this. And looking at those African-American faces and white faces looking up at this guy on the stage, well, I was in tears.
It's hard not to respond to the emotion, you know, people dancing in the streets.
You know, somebody sitting in the room I was with said it reminded him of Armstrong landing on the moon. You know, after he landed, you looked up at the moon and you never saw it the same again after that. He's looking at America like that now. It's the simple fact of his having done this. It changes America.
Two wars, a planet in peril, the worst financial crisis in a century.
David Lindorf, not bad as policy themes for a place to start.
No, he's right. And in one sense, the crisis that the country faces may be to his advantage, oddly enough. The sad reality for Democrats is they always get handed a hunk of garbage from the Republicans when they become president, and then they get blamed for the mess they were handed because they have to raise taxes and so on to combat the problems. But in this particular case, it's so bad that I think people are going to cut him some slack and say that, you know, this wasn't his doing and now he's got to fix it. But boy, we have serious problems. I mean, the global warming thing, the North Pole is disappearing, the waters are rising, methane is boiling out of the tundra. I mean, we have to worry about our grandchildren, and I think he's saying that. So finally, it's a little late, but, you know, he's got to act, and the economy is going to have some much different, more progressive things done than what the Bush administration's been doing so far.
Let's turn now to another clip. Barack Obama mentioning America's role as a leader in a more diplomatic vein and talking about people in forgotten corners of the world who see their destiny as very much connected to ours.
And all those watching tonight from beyond our shores, from parliaments and palaces, to those who are huddled around radios in the forgotten corners of the world, our stories are singular, but our destiny is shared. And a new dawn of American leadership is at hand. To those who would tear the world down, we will defeat you. To those who seek peace and security, we support you. And to all those who have wondered if America's beacon still burns as bright, tonight we proved once more that the true strength of our nation comes not from the might of our arms or the scale of our wealth, but from the enduring power of our ideals, democracy, liberty, opportunity, and unyielding hope.
Again, this resonating with millions all over the world. We're, of course, particularly happy to hear him mention radio listeners. But what about this? Where does he start? Is this a real goal or just rhetoric?
The first thing is we have to have a clean break from this notion of America as the world's cop, from the notion that you solve things by blowing things up. I haven't heard that yet from him. And what I have heard, which I hope is a code word for saying that, is that he wants to work diplomatically. I don't think the UN is going to be a dirty word in the Obama administration. And if that's true, we'll be in much better shape. I mean, if he turns to the UN to solve global problems and allows, you know, any force actions to be done through the UN instead of by the US, we'll be in pretty good shape. But he needs to get these two wars ended. Then the U.S. is in a position to start working cooperatively with other leading powers in the world to solve some of these problems. But if he goes at it in any other way, we're just in the same mess we've been in.
You mentioned U.S. Senator Joe Lieberman on your website, thiscan'tbehappening.net. Lieberman beat challenger Ned Lamont back in 2006 while he ran as an independent, now still a Democrat again. Lieberman has campaigned for Republican John McCain. And Democrats like Reid want to see Lieberman stripped of his seat on committees like Homeland Security. And in Connecticut, too, the 4th District, Democrat Jim Himes beating 11-term Republican Chris Shays. What is the message that voters in New England have issued now to hawkish Democrats and Republicans with this vote?
Joe Lieberman is a neocon. He's a Israel can do no wrong kind of guy, and he is last century's candidate. I mean, he has to be rejected. He has to be tossed out of the Democratic caucus. They don't need him. You know, they're going to have 56 or so senators, and there's plenty of senators who vote like Democrats on most bills, so you don't need the 60. But even if they wanted, you know, I've written that Obama could get the Senate votes he needs by appointing some of these liberal Republicans, because they're all in states with Democratic governors who would, if they went into the cabinet, the Democratic governor would appoint a Democratic replacement in the Senate for them. So he could basically wipe out the Republican filibuster potential by appointing, you know, education secretaries and commerce secretaries and stuff from the Republican rump in the Senate.
You mentioned Israel. He is going to be dealing with a new administration in Israel because of the corruption trial that has now ousted Olmert. And Olmert, interestingly, on his way out, calling for Israel to pull out of the occupied territories. What do you make of their sea change that could be going on? I mean, they now will have Tzvi Lipsy. She comes from a Mossad background. What would you advise Barack Obama to do on Israel and the occupied territories, Palestine?
You know, there, maybe there's a good job for Colin Powell. You know, he could appoint Colin Powell the way I guess it was Clinton did with Senator Mitchell. Send him over to Israel with orders to get the damn thing settled with a two-state solution. I think half of the Israelis, and maybe more, according to most polls, want to have a two-state settlement and end the violence and get it over with, and they recognize the need to do that. They're much more understanding of that than Americans or even a lot of American Jews. You know, I think with Obama coming in and with a new government coming in Israel, which is going to be a fairly minority government, there's an ideal opportunity for Obama to take advantage of his lack of baggage on the issue and to order some settlement that will give the Palestinians a real survivable country and with enough aid to ensure that they can get it off the ground. I think the moment is right for a real crash diplomacy to get this thing settled once and for all.
You wrote some frightening stories about an incident at Barksdale, U.S. military aircraft used illegally to ship armed warheads across America. The Bush administration has now fired nuclear commanders assigned with securing America's nuclear arsenal. What else needs to be done to increase U.S. security on an immediate basis? Again, if we can do a little bit of triage planning for Obama, too.
Well, the first thing he needs to do is completely eviscerate the parallel operation that has been operating out of the vice president's office. There's been like a dual chain of command through the Pentagon for much of the Bush two terms, where the vice president and with the help of Rumsfeld had this whole separate operation, the Office of Special Plans, their own little secret operations through the Defense Intelligence Agency and so on, that was making the Pentagon structure like a Swiss cheese. And that's what made these missing nukes kind of scary, because it made you wonder, you know, was there an alternate chain of command that had those missiles shipped out and taken out of accounting? And this is where it ties into the Middle East. The neocon group that has been like a cabal running the Bush administration has been actively promoting as much violent chaos as they could in the Middle East. And all of this is linked. And I think, fortunately, that Robert Gates was a voice of sanity in the Defense Department, and that with the big win that Obama has had and the chaos in the economy, we're going to see Obama playing a much more active role in the intervening 2 months or 3 months before he actually takes over as president, so that we're unlikely to have a false flag effort or something to get a war going with Iran. I think the generals will resist now because they'll feel like Bush is not really the commander-in-chief anymore. There's a new commander coming in, and they're not going to want to do something that they're going to have to pay for later. So it'll stiffen spines, I think, within the command structure of the military. But Obama's going to have to really reassert a top-down, open role as commander-in-chief, where the generals are answering to him directly, not to Joe Biden. and I think this whole neocon concept of all war all the time has to be erased from Washington, and I think that is going to happen. I don't think that Obama is a closet neocon.
What about George Bush's National Intelligence Agency restructuring? It left so many people wondering just how America's intelligence apparatus is operating, and behind the scenes, you know, what are the American interests in wars we've been talking about that have been so costly to the U.S. economy and that have exacerbated global warming, created tensions with other countries? How should the Obama administration approach intelligence?
I'm hoping that, you know, saner heads are going to prevail here on the grounds that, you know, for example, the neocon mentality is we need to control the oil. We need to own the oil. And, you know, while we spent $500 billion and ultimately, according to Joe Stiglitz, $3 trillion on this huge misadventure and criminal enterprise in Iraq, the Chinese government has been buying long-term contracts for oil from the Iranians at a pittance, guaranteeing them cheap oil for the next 10 or 20 years. And oil is a fungible commodity, and you buy it just like you buy gold or aluminum. And the U.S. could have guaranteed its oil from the Middle East long-term by doing the same thing the Chinese did at much less cost than this war, which isn't even securing the oil, because you can't secure pipelines. Anybody can blow them up with a small, well-placed bomb periodically. So the whole idea is stupid, and I just hope that, you know, we're past these mental cases running foreign policy. I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm being too optimistic that rationality will prevail.
David Lindorf, we had Dar Jamail on. He said U.S. soldiers serving in the Mideast are starting to resist the U.S. military operation there by sort of only pretending to go on operations. They're less willing now to die for these policies. And they're resisting at home, too, U.S. veterans of the Iraq War and Afghan War. But also, U.S. soldiers donated to Barack Obama's campaign 6-1. Over donating to John McCain's campaign. So we're seeing a trend there in what the soldiers themselves will support, right?
Yeah, well, it doesn't surprise me. I lived through the Vietnam War era when there was open insurrection in Vietnam by the troops because of the same thing. They saw that the war was A, pointless, and B, that it was going to be ended at some point anyway, and they just didn't want to be killed in the process. So they basically stopped fighting. I think that is what's happening, and you can't run an army that way. So I think the military understands that this is all bad stuff, and the professional military wants out. They don't want this stuff. So I think that the war is fundamentally lost, and it simply has to be recognized, and a face-saving way has to be found to pull the troops out.
You know, I think a lot of Americans now are wondering how to be active now in playing a role in bringing change to the U.S. and looking at the media. You know, the campaign has really taken a toll, I think, on people's patience.
Yeah, well, you know, that's why we need shows like Your Story, that, you know, my colleagues in the media have really, really fallen down and have stopped doing journalism, stopped providing real information to the public and have just become stenographers to power. It's just been a mass manipulation. I think it's why the comedy shows like The Daily Show or Saturday Night Live are more followed for news than the news. We just have to hope that people are wising up and are turning to the available sources of truth.
Let's actually listen to a bit of Jon Stewart's show. He interviewed Campbell Brown from CNN recently.
Our view is when candidate A is saying it's raining outside and candidate B says it's sunny, as a journalist, I should be able to look outside and say, well, it's sunny, so one of these guys is wrong.
As you know, reality has a liberal bias, and I'm a little shocked that you would even consider looking out the window when you can just call.
You're right.
Somebody with some talking points who can tell you what it's like outside.
But it's trying to get beyond the...
Campbell Brown introducing a new show this week, No Bias, No Bull. But, you know, in her conversation with Jon Stewart, she raised more the question of ideological perspectives at Fox and MSNBC than of really the big fact check that I think American voters have wanted.
Are you competing with organizations like Fox and MSNBC? Is it, do you look at their coverage and say, we have to go in an ideological direction, or we have to go in a just a more sensational or
no.
a louder? Like, what's
no.
your?
None of the above. I mean, they are ideologues, both of them. One from the left, one from the right.
Right.
They're partisans.
Although
they're
MSNBC is not, they have not been taken over by the Borg. They have outposts of ideology, but they're not consistent.
In prime
Fox
time,
is, I think
very, more consistent.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Much more.
But look, it's easier if you take that approach, if you are an ideologue, if you approach it in a partisan way, because you have an automatic punching bag every night. I don't.
We do face the risk, I think, David Lindorf, that this debate about media reform in America disintegrates into a discussion about ideology. And what's needed is a discussion about who provides the facts and who doesn't.
No, I absolutely agree. And I've had the experience when I did the research into the missing warheads story. I took it around to my usual media, you know, Salon, The Nation. No one would run it. And you know where I got that story published? American Conservative magazine, you know, Buchanan's magazine. They also ran a story that I could not sell to left journals about a veteran who had protested the denial of his disability claims against the military as a veteran with angry letters that he wrote to the VA administrator for the region that covered Iowa. And the administrator called Homeland Security and had him arrested at gunpoint, strip searched in front of his kids at 6 a.m, little kids, and hauled off to jail and charged with harassment. And nobody would write about it, but they ran it in American Conservative. I wasn't writing commentaries. I was writing the news reports on what happened with these things. And these left journals of commentary weren't interested. I think it was a matter of they didn't think the stories were that interesting, or they, in the one case, they didn't think they were reliable. And yet, you know, here's another journal on the right which wanted those stories and ran them.
Do you think left and left-leaning editors and writers have become nervous about running some stories that could set off reactions from the right, you know, accusations of conspiracy theory, or politically could cause the right to have a stronger argument for draconian security policy? And we haven't seen, somehow, the networks calling on people who have been right about the stories, whether you're talking about the Iraq War or American security, like your story with Barksdale. You know, the networks aren't calling on you.
I mean, when I saw this at work when I did my story in Mother Jones about the device on Bush's back during the three debates back in 2004. And even though I got that story handed to me when the Times killed it, the source that brought it to the Times came to me, and I managed to get it out a few days before the election in Mother Jones online. But the Times knew that the story was correct because they'd already had it fully written and ready to run by Andy Revkin. And yet, after my story came out in Mother Jones, they had, Baumiller do a hit piece on it and refer to my article as Internet Rumors and Grassy Knoll Thinking. And yet they knew it was factually correct because Andy Revkin had the piece in the can. And the only reason that their editor Keller killed it, he said, was because it was too close to the election. So the public needs to demand from the corporate media that they give them the news, and they need to complain bitterly when they don't get it. And the public needs to demand news, not opinion. It's not about opinion. You can get good news in the Wall Street Journal, you know. But you're right about the left. And one of the things that I hope, and I wrote a piece about this just a couple days ago, that I'm hoping that this victory by Obama, which I predicted would happen, will debunk a disease on the left, which is conspiracy thinking, and the support for the notion that, you know, they are all powerful, that the right has these godlike powers that we on the left don't have, and that they're going to win anyway, that it causes a lot of people to just say, why bother? You know, they're always going to win.
Now, you've written a lot about the issue of the death penalty, as well as civil liberties, civil rights, the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. And we've been looking at another case in Georgia, Troy Davis, on death row, in prison for 19 years there. He has a case for innocence, but the state of Georgia has nearly executed him three times. A lot of people now looking at a moratorium on the death penalty because 130 people have been liberated from death row after it was learned that they were innocent, and 223 cases have been reversed by agencies like the Innocence Project in New York.
You know, this gets to the heart of what the issue is here with Obama, and I think with progressives and how we view Obama. I wrote a piece about why I was supporting Obama as a leftist and got a lot of flack for it, but I got a lot of interesting responses, too. My feeling is this. Politics, and I'm not the first to come up with this. I think, you know, Noam Chomsky has said the same thing, and Howard Zinn, so I'm in good company. Politics in the U.S. or social change in the U.S. is not done by election. It's done in the street. It's done by political pressure between elections. And what we have now is an opportunity. We've elected a guy who I think is open to being pushed from the left, but he's going to have to be pushed hard. And the death penalty is a good example. I mean, he has not said that he's against the death penalty, but he should be made to be against the death penalty. He should be compelled to admit that it cannot be administered fairly, that there will always be mistakes, that even if people aren't executed, they can spend 20 years in a solitary confinement, or 26 years like Mumia Abu-Jamal, and then be found innocent, or certainly not guilty of first-degree murder. It's all about money. You don't see middle-class white people on death row. It just doesn't happen because they get a lawyer and they cut a deal or they get out. At some point with this DNA stuff, we're going to have the proof positive that someone was executed wrongly, and that's going to finish off the death penalty.
Final thoughts on this question of triage for the incoming Obama administration?
The biggest thing that I think we need to see, talking about triage, is that Barack Obama and most of the Democrats elected in this cycle have pledged to reverse the outrageous anti-union legislation that has made it almost impossible to form or even keep a union. If they pass this legislation, I guess it's called Fair Choice, that has been blocked during all the years of the Bush administration, that will make it mandatory for employers to recognize a union if a majority of workers sign cards, no need for an election, and then to bargain fairly and have a first contract, we will see a tsunami of union organizing that will revitalize the labor movement and allow us to have a real organized pressure like what we saw with Franklin Roosevelt that pushed him to do the New Deal. And that's what Barack Obama needs, is this kind of really organized, in-the-street pressure to do the right thing.
David Lindorf, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks. I really appreciate you having me on.
David Lindorf is a columnist for Counterpunch. His most recent book with Barbara Olshansky is The Case for Impeachment, The Legal Argument for Removing President George W. Bush from Office. His website is thiscan'tbehappening.net. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program produced at the studios of WHUS at the University of Connecticut in Storrs, Connecticut. WHUS.org to listen live, Wednesdays at 5 p.m. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions.